In a state with one of the lowest health insurance rates in the nation, a dangerous dip in coverage for many more Texans. That story and more coming up today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. With support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. Other stories we're covering. The Texan in line to become the nation's next top intelligence official. We'll hear what's at stake as the Senate takes up the nomination of Republican John Ratcliffe of Heath to be the next director of national intelligence. Also, despite a ban on such events, a small group in Texas gets one of the nation's first live in-person graduations of 2020. Those stories and a whole lot more as the national news show of You Know Where gets underway. And that happens right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard Time on this Wednesday, the 20th day of May, 2020. I'm David Brown. Hope your Wednesday is going well. I was reminded by a very interesting read this morning in the Texas Tribune that we're about to get our first real-world snapshot of just how hard our state's budget, normally one of the most robust in the nation, stands to get hit by this virus. In his column for The Trib, co-founder Ross Ramsey notes that by week's end, as Texas businesses filed sales tax reports for April, we'll get our first full month look at what the pandemic has done to the Lone Star State's single biggest source of government revenue. Nationally, retail sales fell 16.4% in April. Now, if Texas follows suit, as it likely will, that combined with the drop in taxes from oil, gas, and fuel will put a huge hole in our resources. To say nothing of the fact that Texas's $1.8 billion unemployment fund is almost empty. Ramsey concludes what Texas Comptroller Glenn Hager has warned us here on The Standard. Hard times for the state budget are coming. Now, what that means for all of us is far from clear, but the message could not be more obvious. There will be cuts and a new era of fiscal austerity that's likely to leave few of us unaffected. And if history is any indicator, those who can least afford it will be hurt the most. In a moment, one of the less obvious but most potentially devastating impacts in a state already saddled with the lowest rate of health insurance in the nation. But first, we're going to turn our attention to a story involving a prominent Texan who may have an outsized role in the defense of the entire nation as our top intelligence officer. For this, we're joined by Stephen Slick. He is director of the Intelligence Studies Project, a joint partnership between the William P. Clements Center for National Security and the Robert S. Strauss Center for International Security and Law. Between 2005 and 2009, Mr. Slick served as special assistant to the president and the senior director for intelligence programs and reform on the staff of the National Security Council. Professor Slick, thanks so much for joining us on the Texas Standard.
Good morning, David. My pleasure.
Professor, first off, I suppose we should talk about what it is that the DNI actually does. What does this job entail?
The job was created about 15 years ago in the aftermath of the 9/11 Commission, the 9/11 attacks. Director of National Intelligence is, first and foremost, the head of the U.S. intelligence community. And that's a 17-agency organization scattered around six different cabinet departments in Washington, very important to how we make national security policy and defend ourselves. And the second principal responsibility is the DNI serves as the president's principal intelligence advisor. And that means in practice, he goes to the White House every morning and oversees the production of the presidential daily brief and discusses the president's questions and helps him get the information he needs to make decisions.
Well, you know, we should remind listeners that this isn't Ratcliffe's first time being put forward for consideration. In fact, last year, he took his own name off the table. What was that about?
Well, we don't know exactly, David, but the media reported at the time that the White House had floated Congressman Ratcliffe to be the next director of national intelligence after Senator Dan Coats had resigned. And apparently some Republicans on that panel, including the then chairman, Richard Burr from North Carolina, had expressed some concern that perhaps Congressman Ratcliffe's qualifications were not adequate for the job. He didn't have enough national security experience. And there was also some concern that he'd been a fairly strong and vocal supporter of the president, and that his partisan political views might spill over into the way he conducted U.S. intelligence community business.
This post has been vacant for some time now. Is the concern that this position may be politicized? I'm just trying to understand why it is that this has been such a hard position to fill.
Well, it's certainly safe to say that it's not easy being President Trump's intelligence advisor. That's been proven. Dan Coats, who was a veteran senator and former U.S. ambassador who held the job during the early period of the Trump administration, was frequently frustrated, often criticized, but he held up and defended the community's interests. Now, there is a concern out there amongst intelligence professionals, people in the media, and also members of Congress, that the appointment of Representative Ratcliffe, actually the work of Acting Director of National Intelligence Grinnell, who's currently leading the intelligence community, have been influenced by politics. And it's very important that that not be allowed to take place, because credibility is everything in intelligence. And if the people receiving U.S. intelligence think that it might have been shaded in any way to favor the president's preferred position, well, that's just very damaging, both for our own policy and also for our standing in the world.
Professor, if he's indeed confirmed as DNI, what issues are going to be in front of him? I imagine issues related to this pandemic, certainly.
Yes, of course. There's a tremendous role to be played by the intelligence community in helping the president, U.S. policymakers understand what impacts around the globe this pandemic's going to have. We also have the November presidential election coming up and concerns about Russian interference in that election. So I think Representative Ratcliffe, if he's confirmed in this position, is going to have a great deal to do. The U.S. intelligence community is going to be, as it always is, front and center in keeping the nation safe. And some of those issues are, as you mentioned, the COVID pandemic, Russian election interference, Chinese cybersecurity intrusions. It's a full menu.
Stephen Slick is director of the Intelligence Studies Project, which is a joint partnership of the William P. Clements Center for National Security and the Robert S. Strauss Center for International Security and Law, University of Texas at Austin. Professor, thanks for speaking with us on The Standard.
It's my pleasure, Dave.
More than a million Texans are projected to lose their health insurance because of the economic recession in the U.S. brought on by the coronavirus. That's according to recent reports from the Urban Institute and the Kaiser Family Foundation. That 1 million would add to some 5 million already uninsured in the Lone Star State. Mitchell Schnurman is a business columnist for the Dallas Morning News, where he's been covering the coronavirus's effect on health care service providers. Mitchell, welcome back to The Standard.
Good to talk with you again, David.
When we say more than 1 million Texans are predicted to lose health insurance during the coronavirus recession, are we talking about them losing employer insurance plans? What kind of coverage are we really discussing here?
Yep. In this particular study, it is looking at employer-sponsored insurance. It is the way that the greatest number of Americans get covered. We've got about 160 to 180 million people that are covered by insurance that they say sponsored by their employer. Because of all the layoffs, 36 million, I think, claims have been filed so far. That has led to a projection of about 25 million people in the nation will probably lose employer-sponsored insurance. It'll hit us harder than anywhere else, in part because what this study looks at is who is going to then sign up or get additional coverage. That's really the tricky point. Everyone is going to get hit by this loss of employer-sponsored insurance because layoffs and furloughs are happening across the entire nation. The question is, how many have somewhere else to go? Well, across the U.S., 7 in 10 people, they project, will get coverage elsewhere. In Texas, it's just 1 in 2.
Wow. Oh, when it comes to other health insurance options, what are they for unemployed Texans? COBRA, Medicaid, what?
Generally, what happens is COBRA is open to everyone, and so is the ACA, the Affordable Care Act exchanges. This is considered a qualifying event. When you lose your job and you lose your employer-sponsored insurance, you are allowed to enroll in other coverage, but you have to have the money to pay for that. So, and you also have to have the inclination to do it. COBRA is pretty expensive. It means you can continue your corporate coverage that you have, but you pay 100% of it. The ACA exchange is one of the options. You can sign up. Now, more Texans Americans should probably do that. We do quite poorly in the share of eligible people signing up for the ACA exchanges. And unlike COBRA, it's very likely you're going to get a subsidy. In Texas, over 85% of the people who sign up for the ACA coverage actually get a portion of that paid by the federal government. Sometimes the costs are as low as $75 or $80 a month. Then finally, you mentioned Medicaid. And Medicaid is really the safety net program around the country for what we call the working poor. It's people right. who are making up to, for a single person, that's about $18,000 a year. A single mom with two kids, that might be more like $25,000 or a little bit around there. And then you are qualified for coverage. However, in Texas, we have not expanded Medicaid. So that's right. not really an option for us.
I want to touch on that because it's important to note that a lot of people getting unemployment checks may be actually getting too much income to qualify for Medicaid because of those income restrictions that you mentioned. What's the possibility for the state expanding Medicaid? I mean, I guess the state has set the lowest income threshold in the country to qualify, right?
Right. So you're really talking two things there. Let's go over the first, to be qualified for Medicaid. That is, what is the income limit? What's the maximum you can make? And once you make more than that, we're not going to let you sign up. Well, Texas is the stingiest in the nation. There's no doubt about it. It's 17% of the federal poverty level. For a single mom with two kids, if she is making more than $317 a month, she makes too much to get Medicaid. Then you ask the question about, well, why don't we expand? Well, there are 36 states that have expanded Medicaid. We are in that small group that has not. Many of the states that have expanded are led by Republican governors and Republican legislatures. The reason that it's so attractive is the federal government pays 90% of the cost. In our regular Medicaid program that is already existing, the federal government only covers 62% of the cost. So most states have chosen to expand. Why haven't we? I'd say it's raw politics.
Mitchell Schnurman is covering this story as business columnist for the Dallas Morning News. Mitchell, thanks so much for getting us up to speed. We appreciate it.
Always good to talk to you. Be safe out there, David.
Let's find out what Texans are talking about on this Wednesday. Here's our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. Hello there, Wells.
Hello, David. We're hearing from Texans without health insurance whose lack of coverage has been thrown into sharp relief by the coronavirus. On our Facebook page, Janice Hitchcock says that she lost her health insurance due to the economic recession in 2008. And like many other Texans, she's been uninsured since. Indeed, Texas, already the state with the most uninsured people in the nation. John Michael Tullisk says the rest of the civilized world has universal health care that's not tied to employment. Why don't we? Just a couple of the reactions we're seeing out there on social media, David. And just one story we're keeping an eye on, another story that has folks talking, the latest volley in a legal battle over mail-in voting in Texas. This new development, a federal judge's ruling that all Texans qualify for a mail-in ballot during the coronavirus pandemic. I'll be back with reactions to that story later in the show.
Yeah, we're going to have more on that decision from that federal court coming up in the Texas Roundup, which is a little later in the broadcast. In the meantime, keep those comments coming. Wells Dunbar is looking for you, and he'll be back with more of the talk of Texas in about 35 minutes or so here on The Standard.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, helping patients fight cancer with telemedicine. Virtual online appointments are available for patients to continue their cancer journey while practicing safe social distancing. More at TexasOncology.com.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. A few weeks ago, the school superintendent in Dallas declared all graduations this year would be virtual. But a small group of Conrad High School seniors in Dallas recently celebrated one of the first in-person graduations in the country since the pandemic started, one of a few small groups given permission to do so. KERA's Bill Zeeble learned these high schoolers were special in another way, earning their two-year college degrees.
Cars started lining up at 5 p.m. for the 6 o'clock Friday ceremony. It's in the back parking lot of Emmett Conrad High School in Dallas's Vickery Meadows neighborhood. 18-year-old Collegiate Academy senior Jennifer Martinez pops her head out of the sunroof of her dad's balloon-festooned SUV. She says students were asked a week ago if they wanted this.
Even though they're doing something small for us, it's something that we work hard for.
Martinez and her classmates did work hard, says history teacher Patricia Fitzwater, She taught every one of these 88 seniors.
The early college academies for Dallas ISD are focused on students who are typically underrepresented in college, first-time college goers. So it's a really, really big deal for these students to have not only their high school diploma, but also their associate's degree. It's a huge deal.
Another huge deal for every graduate is wearing that cap and gown. Volunteers hand them out to every senior as each car pulls up.
Hey! What we got? I need to height. 5'8 and 5'1. 5'1.
With microphone in hand, Assistant Principal Vivian Chandler Fairley admires her Collegiate Academy graduates.
You guys have received your cap and gowns, and you look marvelous in that Thunderduck purple.
That's the color of Richland College. Everyone in this graduating class also earned the maximum 60 hours from the Dallas College while simultaneously completing their high school requirements. With their associate's degrees, graduates are already 2 years toward a four-year college diploma.
Well, we got more credits and we're ready for college already.
Marcela Catalan will enter Texas Women's University this fall, pursuing a degree in graphic arts. She's not sure yet if classes will be online or in person. Back in the parking lot, the ritual of reading every graduate's name out loud is about to begin. Conrad Principal Temezgen Asmaron says these young adults deserve more than this.
When everybody was enjoying Thanksgiving, they were taking courses. When people were going for Christmas vacation, they were in Christmas classes. And that's why we're going out of our way, give them the experience of graduation because they deserve a celebration.
Then Asmaram warms up the crowd. Every graduate seems to have at least two, if not more, family members close by, cheering and honking their horns.
Graduating class, family members, let's give it up for class of 2020.
As the staff prepares to read the list of Collegiate Academy grads, Assistant Principal Fairley reminds the hundreds here of the rules.
Remember, you signed an agreement saying that we will practice social distancing and that you will remain near your cars.
All right, Associate of Science, Autumn Alphonse.
All 88 names are read. Graduates pick up their diplomas June 10th. School leaders say there's something special in store for these young adults when they show up. But for now, they're keeping those plans a secret. I'm Bill Zeeble in Dallas.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, providing community relief actions for the COVID-19 crisis, including early dividend distribution to eligible policyholders. More at texasmutual.com/dividends.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. For some high school seniors, the coronavirus has pushed them to make last-minute changes to their choice of higher education. Texas Public Radio's Camille Phillips reports on the outbreak's ripple effects for the class of 2020 in the Alamo City.
Congratulations, the class of 2020.
Every year, San Antonio holds a big event for high school seniors from across the city to celebrate their decision to go to college. There are usually t-shirt giveaways and college mascot dance-offs. This year, the party went virtual.
Y'all, virtual graduation and virtual college signing day, y'all are the ones, man. You're doing so, so well.
With so many senior milestones canceled, this year's celebration took on extra significance. Now more than ever, seniors needed to know that their decision to go to college was worth recognition. When the coronavirus hit, San Antonio educators worried that high school seniors would give up on college because of financial hardship.
Parents are losing jobs. Students are losing jobs. I've had students who have considered applying for unemployment.
College Access Advisor Fatima Montes works with students at three high schools in working-class neighborhoods. She says a lot of seniors are changing their college plans because of the coronavirus outbreak.
A lot of what I'm hearing right now is, why am I going to pay for out-of-state tuition? Why am I going to pay private school tuition if I'm not even going to be able to be there fall semester?
Montes says students who were planning on leaving San Antonio are now staying in town. And students who have lost income because of the virus are choosing more affordable options, like the local community college system, Alamo Colleges. The Alamo Colleges District has a new free tuition program for local seniors, and most of our schools had all of their seniors sign up as a backup plan,
even if they originally wanted to go to a four-year university.
That's one less thing for them to have to worry about right now, right? They don't have
Montez says most of her students still plan on going to college, but a handful at each of her schools told her even going to college part-time wasn't an option for them right now.
They're like, no, I need to work. And not just for like their benefit, not just for paying for school, but like for the benefit of their family, right? So it's a tough conversation to have with, you know, someone in high school, right? They're supposed to have all of this laid out in front of them.
A good number of San Antonio seniors had local colleges in mind even before the coronavirus hit.
I love San Antonio, so going to college here would just be great too, but...
Edison High School senior Miranda Trevino says she chose the University of Texas at San Antonio because she likes its kinesiology program. Her family also makes less than $51,000 a year, qualifying her for UTSA's new free tuition scholarship.
That was also a huge thing when deciding, because I was like, okay, my tuition's getting paid for, everything's going to be covered, like, I'll also be getting money back, like, so I could use it for books or use it for stuff on campus.
Miranda says she's grateful for all the support she's gotten from her college-bound advisors the past few months, especially because she's the first person in her family to go to college.
It's hard to go ask a family member, like, hey, what do I do? Because they don't know. So, like, our college advisors from school being there for us all the time, it's just taking that amount of stress off not being in school. It helps a lot.
Miranda's high school college advisor, Regan Arevalos, says most of his students' post-high school plans haven't changed, but he says many of them have family members who have lost jobs.
I've definitely seen a difference in the amount of students that have gotten jobs are working way more, like close to full-time hours now to help support their families, which is always kind of an issue that we're worried about just because them just burning themselves out at that age.
Arevalos says his biggest worry is that the pandemic is adding even more hurdles to an already long list of tasks students need to complete this summer before they can enroll in college. And at each one of those hurdles, there's a risk that a student could give up.
For a student to easily just say, you know what, never mind, I'm just going to get a job. I wanted to go to college, but it's just too much. You know what, I'd rather just go to work now, get some money, and then I'll deal with it later, maybe.
All he and his colleagues can do is offer the class of 2020 advice when they need it and celebrate their big dreams. I'm Camille Phillips in San Antonio.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. The Texas Republican Attorney General plans to appeal a decision significantly expanding access to absentee voting during the coronavirus pandemic. Houston Public Media's Andrew Schneider reports a federal judge ruled late Tuesday all voters can apply for mail-in ballots.
Judge Fred Beery of the Western District of Texas issued the injunction. Effectively, he said it would violate the U.S. Constitution for Texas to deny absentee ballots to voters who fear contracting COVID-19 when voting in person. The judge's move supersedes a stay by the Texas Supreme Court last week in a related state lawsuit. The Texas Democratic Party is the plaintiff in both the state and federal suits. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton said he would immediately appeal the federal court's decision to the U.S. Fifth Circuit, widely regarded as the most conservative appeals court in the country. Time is running short for a resolution of the issues before Texans next go to the polls. Early voting in the Texas primary runoff election begins in less than 6 weeks. I'm Andrew Schneider in Houston.
Financial assistance will be available soon for Texas farmers and ranchers who have suffered losses amid the COVID-19 outbreak. The U.S. Department of Agriculture announced Tuesday it's earmarked $16 billion in relief funding for direct payments to U.S. agricultural producers. The Texas Farm Bureau's Laramie Adams says live cattle futures and commodity markets have fallen sharply since the outbreak began.
COVID-19 has been devastating for our farmers and ranchers across Texas. Even prior to COVID-19, our farmers and ranchers were dealing with an unprecedented downturn in net farm economy, down actually over 50% of what it was just 5 years ago.
The USDA begins accepting applications for the aid May 26th. And today is the last day essential workers in Texas can apply for subsidized emergency child care. KUT's Becky Fogel has more.
The Texas Workforce Commission is phasing out the program now that Governor Greg Abbott has allowed child care providers in the state to reopen. The emergency aid is available to people in several professions, including health care workers, first responders, and grocery store employees. Those who are already getting assistance will continue to receive subsidized child care for the three-month period they were approved for. Back in March, the TWC allocated $200 million to local workforce development boards to help cover the cost of child care for essential workers.
The state agency says essential workers can apply for TWC's regular subsidized child care program at any time if they meet income requirements. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from the online UT High School, offering a full-time diploma program and individual courses for students from any school. Courses can be started anytime to catch up or get ahead. Learn more at highschool.utexas.edu.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. Texas Governor Greg Abbott says daycares can reopen immediately. That may come as a big relief to some of those who've been juggling kids and work and more at home for the past few months. Our managing producer, Laura Rice, is a mom of two very young kids, and lately she's been experiencing some guilt over how much screen time her toddler's been getting.
Yeah. So much so that this is the second story I've proposed on the topic. Did you catch this interview we did a few weeks back?
Well, I think it's important that we recognize right now is a very different time. Parents need to be patient, flexible, and collaborative with their kids. Even so, too much screen time is too much.
That's John Lasser, and he knows what he's talking about. He's Associate Dean in the College of Education at Texas State University. He also wrote a book about kids and tech. His advice is a lot like what my pediatrician also told me about screen time for my not-quite-3-year-old.
For early childhood, above 18 months, they say no more than an hour a day.
Ha! Anyone else failing miserably at that right now? Listen, I know there are more difficult positions to be in at the moment. I'm grateful to be working full-time, but there's no doubt that's hard without childcare. And even with daycares reopening, some parents may be hesitant to send kids back right away, or may not be able to afford to.
You know, how do you get even 30 minutes of work in?
That's another busy mom, Iris Oved. She has a 3-year-old.
One of the ways that I get her off the screen is to say that we can think about Peppa Pig and we can think about what she did today.
Oved has a background in developmental psychology and philosophy, and it may sound wild at first, but she thinks even the youngest kids are natural philosophers.
They're just so curious and want to figure things out and really want to like understand the world, right? The why questions.
She's the executive director of San Francisco's The Paradox Lab. It's part portable museum, part online resource that tries to engage with the inquisitive parts of kids' brains. And she says we can all do that right now at home, even with TV.
What kinds of characters were in this show? What was the challenge that came up? Do you think you would solve it in the same way?
Her suggestions reminded me of something else from that first interview with education expert John Lasser.
So, for example, you could be on a screen making art, making music, writing a novel, versus passively consuming.
Let's face it, passive consumption is the primary option for a toddler. But armed with some questions Oved provided, I decided to experiment with this idea of engaging after that screen time.
What's your name?
Two.
How old are you?
2 months old.
2 months old?
Yeah.
I think you're 2 years old.
Yeah.
It didn't start out so well.
What are your favorite shows to watch?
I don't know.
Dead end. I need a better prompt. Take two.
Did you like Daniel Tiger today?
Yeah.
What happened?
Okay, my bad. Gotta turn off the TV first.
Who are the characters on Pinkalicious?
The bell come out, the little bell.
I thought Pinkalicious was about a little girl and her brother. They had bears on there today?
Yeah. Nope. Not today.
I need a pep talk. Oved says it does help if you know a little bit about the show so that you're not completely coming from the outside. But she also says it may just take some experimenting. Some questions might not work for some kids, and especially older kids might get quickly suspicious.
Again, that's really why we want the questions to be interesting for the adults, so it doesn't feel like we're trying to make an educational exercise for them or that we're giving them a quiz.
Got it. Trying again.
So what was the problem in the show today?
They can't find horses.
What would you have done if you couldn't find horses? Where would you go?
And say, people, I can have horses?
Better. She's obviously more into it, and we're quickly not talking about the show anymore. We're just talking, even though it doesn't always make sense to me.
Hey, you.
Oh, did you make me a sandwich?
It's a newbie doobie doobie.
Oh, okay. Perfect. Oved says the point is to use whatever we can in whatever situation to engage our kids. Not just because we want to find something good in something like too much screen time, but because showing interest in what our kids find interesting is a good thing. At least that's the lesson I'm trying to take away, because I know my toddler is learning lessons right now too.
Mommy wants to go outside. Let's go outside, June.
No, I'm working right now. Sorry.
I'm Laura Rice for the Texas Standard.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Tech University's online school program, TTU K-12, offering fully online courses for kindergarten through 12th grade to start anytime from anywhere. Learn more by searching TTU K-12. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Beauty, they say, is in the eye of the beholder, but it's tough to argue that some animals, well, are just more beautiful than others. The sea slug, for example, is a critter many might rank fairly low, aesthetically speaking. But perhaps that needs to be reconsidered, given how a particular species recently caught the eye of Texas beachcombers. The Texas Standard's Michael Marks has more.
The sea slug in question doesn't look anything like a slug.
It kind of makes me think of like a dragonfly.
That's Jamie Kennedy, a park ranger at Padre Island National Seashore. She's talking about a slug called Glaucus atlanticus, better known as the blue dragon. They're really remarkable-looking creatures, like something you'd find in Harry Potter or Pokemon, rather than the Atlantic.
You know, they really do look kind of like dragons, and it's a very pretty bluish kind of silvery with a little bit of, you know, white or gray on it. And then it has two sets of wings, almost, I would say.
Blue dragons are tiny, just a few centimeters long at most, but they eat one of the most feared creatures of the sea, the Portuguese man-o-war, a jellyfish-like invertebrate known for its powerful sting. The sting is typically a repellent, but that's the draw for the blue dragon. They chop off parts of a man-o-war's tentacles and then store the stinging cells they've consumed in their wings.
And so they're basically preying on the Portuguese man of war and then stealing their stinging power and then putting it at the tips of their fingers so they can then use that as their own protection.
So their sting can be just as powerful as the Portuguese man of war. Kennedy knows a lot about these slugs, especially for someone who's never actually seen one in the flesh. Blue dragons are a rare find. They blend in with the water and are only occasionally found washed up on shore, which is why what happened at Padre Island earlier this month was so unusual.
This is the first time in over 2 years that I've heard of anyone seeing them or finding them.
In early May, a family who didn't know what they'd found sent a photo to Padre Island National Seashore of a blue dragon in a green bucket, asking what it was. Kennedy posted the picture to the park's Facebook page. And then
we got a ton of comments on the Facebook post saying that other people had found them in the park or nearby the park and lots of pictures of them. So definitely a lot of them sound to have been washing up that weekend.
It's not real clear why. Blue dragons use an internal air bubble to stay afloat and move by bobbing around with the wind and tide. So Kennedy thinks that maybe a group of blue dragons were born nearby and then were all pushed ashore by the same current. A coincidence, like a meteor shower.
It's rare, right? There were dragons in the park and, you know, they're pretty rare and now they're gone.
Still, if you're on the coast this summer, keep an eye out for dragons, but keep your hands to yourself. Seeing something so rare is unforgettable enough. No need to add getting stung by a sea slug to the experience. For the Texas Standard, I'm Michael Marks.
It's not the longest river in the U.S., but perhaps there's no other that's changed course so much or caused as much controversy as the one at Texas's southern border. Its name, of course, means Big River, but our commentator, W.F. Strong, has unearthed some lesser-known history about how the Rio Grande got its name.
10 years ago, I was touring the great Catedral de Sevilla in Spain when I got into an unexpectedly informative conversation about Texas with an 80-year-old guide of that majestic church. When he discovered that I was from South Texas, he asked me in perfect British English, "Did you know that your river there in Texas is named for our river, the Guadalquivir?" I said I didn't understand how that could be. "How do you get Rio Grande from Guadalquivir?" He said, "Guadalquivir is a Spanish distortion of the Arabic, meaning the brave river or the great river. So when the original cowboys of Andalusia from southern Spain settled northern Mexico, they thought the river looked like the Guadalquivir, so they called it the Rio Bravo." Well, I can't speak for or against the veracity of the guide's story, but as a story, it's interesting, which is the first rule of stories. Some say Álvarez de Pineda first named the Rio Grande El Rio de las Palmas in 1519. But others say he was really at the mouth of the Pánuco River near Tampico, much farther south in Mexico. But we have to consider the Pineda stone as evidence, which was found deep in the sand near the mouth of the Rio Grande in 1974, with Pineda's name etched on it, along with the number of men and ships he had with him. Many believe it's fake, but just as many feel it's real. We do know that the explorer Juan de Oñate called the river El Rio Grande in writing in 1598. Strangely, Cabeza de Vaca crossed it 70 years earlier on his wild trek across Texas and Mexico, but never mentioned the river at all. The river has been called Rio Grande del Norte and Rio Bravo del Norte. Today, we know for sure that it is called the Rio Grande River or the Rio Grande River on the Texas side and the Rio Bravo on the Mexican side. At one time, it was certainly brave and grand, with steamboats piloted by Texas legends like Richard King and his business partner Mifflin Kennedy, who traveled 130 miles inland all the way to Rio Grande City. And in a rare case, a steamboat went all the way to Laredo. Though the river, once half a mile wide at some points, certainly earned its name, now we might call it El Arroyo Valiente, or Courageous Creek, because along its 2,000-mile journey from Colorado to the Gulf, it's often no bigger than a creek. So many cities and towns along its banks pull water from it that it is a mere trickle of its former self. And down toward the mouth, the river is incredibly crooked, like an enormous water moccasin sunning itself in lazy loops and curls. General Zachary Taylor said his soldiers believed it was so crooked there seemed to be only one shore. I can attest to this myself. I once rode my motorcycle along the northern trails that follow the curves of the river and found myself looking north across the water. Even though I was not on the Mexican side, my eyes told me otherwise. It's terribly disorienting. Riverboat pilots said it was 100 horse miles from Brownsville to Rio Grande City, but 175 river miles. The river is to Texas and northern Mexico what the Nile is to Egypt. It is, quite simply, life itself, and always has been. There are still quiet, isolated spots along the river where enormous canyon walls rise toward the heavens 2,000 feet overhead, where exotic parrots fly in screeching flocks through wild palm orchards, places you can sit and channel the words author John Graves wrote about a different Texas river. If you are lucky and reverent, and hush for a moment the doubts in your head, sometimes God will whisper in your ear. I'm W.F. Strong. These are stories from Texas. Some of them are true.
W.F. Strong is a Fulbright Scholar and Professor of Culture and Communication at the University of Texas, Rio Grande Valley. You can check out more of his stories from Texas on iTunes or wherever fine podcasts are served.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with small and mid-sized companies by helping to unify their businesses and achieve digital transformation. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises. Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, dedicated to improving healthcare in North Texas and around the world through pursuits like the new TCU and UNTHSC School of Medicine, educating empathetic scholars. TCU, lead on.
You're listening to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Southwest Airlines CEO Greg Kelly said that risk of COVID-19 transmission is comparable to catching it anywhere else. Kelly said that airplanes are, quoting here, as safe as an environment as you're going to find in regards to coronavirus transmission. But is that a fact? Here to help separate the fact from fiction, Madeline Meckelberg with PolitiFact Texas, based at the Austin American Statesman. Madeline, good to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
So where did Kelly make this claim exactly?
So he said this during an interview on Face the Nation, and they were talking about air travel during this time of the coronavirus. Mm-hmm. During the interview, Margaret Brennan asked him to assess the risk of virus transmission on airplanes and what safety measures are in place right now, given that, you know, on an airplane, there's such limited space with the cramped aisle and a shared bathroom and people walking back and forth to get to their seat. And right. I think we've got audio of what he said in reply.
Let's listen.
I don't think the risk on an airplane is any greater risk than anywhere else. And in fact, you just look at the layered approach that we use. It's as safe as an environment as you're going to find.
So what does he mean there, Madeline, when he's talking about a layered approach?
So we reached out to Southwest, and what they said there is that he's talking about the different measures that the airline has in place right now to protect its employees and customers on their planes. Mm-hmm. And part of that, and this is important when we're talking about the risk of transmission, are these high efficiency particulate air filters that are in use on airplanes, and they help to filter and ventilate the air. And these are the same kind of filters that you might find in hospitals that are used to provide patients there with clean air.
You know, that was the first thing that came to mind was I know there's a lot of recirculated air on airplanes, but even with high filters, those sorts of precautions, I would imagine there's still a risk of transmission on a plane. Nonetheless, I mean, there are a lot of people in cramped quarters, right?
Right, that's exactly right. And there have actually been case studies about other diseases and transmissions on planes. There's obviously research is ongoing still about this new coronavirus, but in 2003, there was a study that was done, and it showed that 16 people tested positive for SARS after flying on a plane with a symptomatic passenger. So that shows how quickly it can be transmitted in that small space. And there's also evidence that H1N1, the virus, was spread between passengers on a plane during that outbreak. But
oh boy.
You're right. The problem is that even though these planes have these ventilation systems, it's still possible for the virus to be transmitted because of the cramped quarters. And this happens through the really small droplets or aerosols. And those can stay airborne for about 3 to 4 minutes before being sucked into the ventilation system. So during that time, if you're in close proximity with anybody, you could come into contact with those small droplets and the virus can be transmitted. And that being said, there, even though studies are ongoing about the new coronavirus, there have been a few documented cases of an individual being infected after flying on a plane, but mm-hmm. those are few and far between.
Well, then let's get back to the nugget of the claim here. Is a plane a safer environment when it comes to contracting the coronavirus? It doesn't sound like it would be.
Yeah, so not really here. The important thing is that on a plane, people are not able to make decisions about how much space to put between themselves and others like they can through the normal course of their life. And we know that social distancing like that helps to reduce transmission. So Kelly might be right that the risk is lower on an airplane compared to other forms of transportation, like a bus or a subway, where they don't have the same air ventilation tools. But saying that it's safer compared to any other environment is really an overstatement.
The ruling then.
We rated this claim mostly false.
Mostly false. That's the ruling from PolitiFact on Southwest CEO Gary Kelly's claim that airlines are, quoting here, as safe as an environment as you're going to find when it comes to COVID-19 transmission risk. Madeline Meckelberg is with PolitiFact Texas. Madeline, thanks, and we'll talk with you again next week.
Looking forward to it.
And you are listening
to the Texas Standard.
I can't remember what it was like to travel on a plane. Maybe that's a good thing, maybe not so much. I know the fares are kind of crazy right now.
Yeah,
so
seriously.
Low.
I have seen some very low fares, and some for flights pretty far out. So if you want to roll the dice and say, hey, maybe things will clear up by the end of the summer, who knows?
Who knows? Who knows? Wells Dunbar is our social media editor. Wells, what are you seeing on social media right now?
Well, we heard about this story some in the news roundup, this latest development in this back and forth in the courts. A federal judge now ruling that all Texans qualify for mail-in ballot during the coronavirus pandemic. And as we heard in the roundup, this one's certain to be appealed to the Fifth Circuit Court, where there's some question as to whether or not this ruling will stand. But for now, lots of reactions we're seeing about this ruling allowing folks to request a mail-in ballot via Facebook. Vicki Rollins says, hopefully the county can handle the increased mail out, which has seemed questionable in the past. Of course, elections administered at that local, that county level. Meanwhile, Stacey Britton says, Texas doesn't have to reinvent the wheel. This has been done successfully in other states for quite some time. And one user, David, says she's already filed her request for a mail-in ballot. So obviously a lot of interest around this topic continuing going forward here during the pandemic. Another set of reactions to a story we heard from producer Laura Rice, our own friend Laura Rice there on the show, about the difficulties of navigating screen time for kids amid the pandemic. I know this is one we wrestle with here in the Dunbar household as well. Robert Flood gets to the nut of the issue here on Facebook. He asks another question for folks here is, how are children approaching screen time for parents?
Right.
I say in this household, it's really kind of an odd feeling at like 9 o'clock in the evening, where it's like, oh wow, we can actually watch some TV ourselves now. You're so burnt out on Daniel
Tiger. I don't know what you're talking about. I have no idea what you're talking about.
None whatsoever. I do like this comment. Another comment on our Facebook page. This one from Justin Klumpner. He's kind of got one weird trick, I suppose you could say. He says, I've switched the language setting on my kid's favorite show to Spanish. Now I don't feel so bad when they power through 4 episodes. It's not binge watching. It's a foreign language class.
They're learning something. Exactly.
That could be.
Nice strategy.
There might be something to that. You know, I don't know if that's ever happened to you, where it's like, you know, the kid gets a hold of the remote and it screws up the language settings or the subtitles.
Actually,
or something
I
like
kind
that.
Of enjoy that, to be totally honest. It's like a challenge, right? I mean, it's fun.
It definitely is. So again, folks adjusting to life here in the so-called new normal. Also continuing to keep an eye on other issues here at the federal level. Some interesting stuff here with Mike Pompeo, our chief of staff for, or not chief of staff.
Secretary of State.
Secretary of State for the Trump administration, coming under fire for these, apparently these lavish dinners he has hosted with potential donors, it says. That one generating a lot of attention here on social media from what I'm seeing, David.
Well, we're out of time. You're going to have to hold that thought. Well, you don't have to. You can always reach out to us at Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice. We'd love to hear from you. Wells Dunbar is our social media editor. He's going to be back here tomorrow. I'll be back here tomorrow. So will the rest of the Texas Standard team. And we hope you will join us. Till then, I'm David Brown, wishing you a wonderful Wednesday.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com. Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and St. David's Foundation. Additionally, Texas Mutual Insurance Company is a founding sponsor of Texas Standard.